This week on Making Contact.
Could you leak responsibly? Could you come up with a system that processes it so that we agree that maybe this should come to light, but there should be redactions to protect the sources and methods?
Since 2007, WikiLeaks has published thousands of classified documents on the internet. From the Afghan War Diary to the Iraq War Logs and the U.S. State Department's diplomatic cables, WikiLeaks has become a lightning rod for controversy.
The freedom of the press should not be restricted to the New York Times, but has to include WikiLeaks. We don't fight that. We are giving up on 200 years of the rights that we have fought to protect for the freedom of the press.
On this edition, excerpts from a panel discussion, WikiLeaks, why it matters, why it doesn't. I'm Kyungjin Lee, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Most of the media's coverage of WikiLeaks has focused on the journalistic and national security implications of publishing classified documents online. These are important considerations, but not the only ones. How do private businesses and technology fit into the WikiLeaks debate? And what about protections for whistleblowers on the internet? These are the questions that five experts from the business, technology, and legal sectors debated in Santa Clara, California in January 2011. Daniel Ellsberg is a former government official made famous for releasing the Pentagon Papers. Clay Shirky is an adjunct professor in the Interactive Telecommunications Program at New York University. Peter Thiel is the president of Clarium Capital, an investment management firm. Jonathan Zittrain is a law and computer science professor at Harvard University. And Roy Singham is the founder and chairman of ThoughtWorks, a business software company. The panel was moderated by Paul Jay, CEO and senior editor of the Real News Network.
So in terms of the significance of the attempt to close down WikiLeaks on the internet, the great amount of pressure to try some way to prosecute Julian Assange, and I believe there's a grand jury deliberating that now. What does your experience teach us, Daniel?
Well, I had the very unusual experience of being the first person ever prosecuted for a leak to the press or the public in the United States. The act under which I was prosecuted, namely the Espionage Act, had been designed for espionage and had never been used for anything else. Other than against spies who, with the intent specified to harm the interests of the United States or help a foreign power. My prosecutors did not charge that of me. On the contrary, they used the clause in the Espionage Act, which they're using against Bradley Manning also, and which they would use against Assange if they decide to do it. And that makes no distinction, by the way, in its target. It had never been used, as I say, for in connection with an leak or a disclosure of classified information. And the reason for that was really that it had been always understood that that was intended to cover spying and that we did not want, Congress did not want, an Official Secrets Act of the British kind, which criminalizes any and all disclosure of classified information, of government secret information. And the people working on that act or other proposals by administrations to have an Official Secrets Act, Congress had always rejected that on the grounds that that went against the core of our democracy, the First Amendment, the necessity, if the public is to be in any sense sovereign, it had to be informed, that the press played an essential role in that, and that it was the role of the press to inform the public of information that of the most embarrassing and sensitive kind, namely information about mistakes, errors, crimes, reckless policies, incompetence, the sort of thing that I can tell you as somebody who was in the government is subject to the closest guarding from its political rivals, from the electorate, and from the public. We would have an Official Secrets Act if Clinton had not been led to veto that act in the year 2000. And it would criminalize what Assange did, it would criminalize what Bradley Manning did, definitely what I did. And actually, it would go a lot further, because the wording of that act, the only act that the government has found to be claimed to be applicable, makes no distinction between officials, press, bloggers, anyone without authorized access to the information, passing it on to anybody unauthorized, And that means, and this sounds absurd, but it's the way it's written, that would mean that any reader of the New York Times reading a story saying this is a classified document to which we've been given access, the reader is not authorized, passing it to her husband or her child would be passing it to an unauthorized person and just as prosecutable in terms of the wording of the act as an official or a consultant, as I was, or Bradley Manning or Julian Assange or anyone. And it could apply to everyone. Extremely broad. It was always assumed that that would be unconstitutional if it were applied to disclosures. And that's why prior to Obama, there were only, in a world where leaks occur every other day, there were three prosecutions, of which mine was the first. The Supreme Court has never actually ruled on whether it's constitutional to put this much material, we're talking billions to trillions of pages of classified documents over the last 60 years, to put that all beyond public discussion, not just by threat of firing or clearance, which is very effective and has kept far too many secrets, but to add to that criminal sanctions. Is that constitutional? The Supreme Court has never yet addressed that. I think that is related to the strange fact that President Obama, who came in promising transparency, who has in fact, in the area of national security and homeland security, been as secretive as any prior administration, including George W. Bush, and in some ways more secretive, and one way in particular I'm about to mention. I said before Obama there were three indictments. Obama has brought five in these 2 years. If he brought it against Assange, if they did six, it would be twice as many as all previous presidents put together. And what's going on here? Well, it's part of a policy of generally use of state secrets privilege, use of against dismissing lawsuits, being totally secretive, not being at all forthcoming on freedom of information in terms of these areas. Why is it that Obama is pressing this so strongly? This is before WikiLeaks, remember, except for Bradley. The previous four were before WikiLeaks, and two of them were for acts undertaken under Bush, which Bush had not indicted. Thomas Drake and Shammai Leibowitz, who's in prison now. So in other words, this "we're not looking back" applies to the myriad crimes of the Bush administration, torture, aggressive war, warrantless wiretapping, crimes that actually strike at the heart of our Constitution as well as our domestic law. No looking back on those. The only looking back is on whistleblowers. So there is a war on whistleblowing. To me, and again, why Obama so much, I have a hypothesis. It's really, this is just very speculative. I think he's feels more vulnerable to whistleblowers than either his predecessor, because he's doing many of the same things. One of the great secrets in the cables released is how little difference there is from 2008 to 2009. They're the same practices, the same torture, not that much difference. But Bush was proud of it. He did it secretly at first, but when it came out, torture? We don't torture, but what we do, we do. And I don't apologize for it. NSA warrantless wiretapping? No problem, need it. I think Obama's a little more embarrassed about all that coming out, that he's acting in the same lines, that he has a new war that he's escalating, added to Bush's war in Afghanistan. And he really wants to do what other presidents have always wanted to do, shut down leaks that they don't control, the leaks they don't make. I think Obama's doing it more aggressively than any previous president, and specifically, he's doing it by treating the act that I was charged under as an official secrets act, as an act that criminalizes all leaks. And if he gets a conviction of any of these people, not just Manning or Assange, if they go up to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court takes it and doesn't notice that it is unconstitutional, he has a very broad official secrets act, and from then on, all he has to do to find out who is the source of any leak with a clear-cut crime is to call in the reporter whose byline is on the head of that column and say, "We're not charging you with anything. We're not against the press. We're for the press. Just who committed the crime?" And if the person can't take the Fifth Amendment, he or she is not being charged with anything, they just either tell or they go to jail indefinitely for contempt. Judith Miller lasted 85 days. And some of them will last longer, but a lot of them won't. And from then on, no source will have any basis for assuming or hoping that their name for this whistleblowing will be anonymous. Their only recourse will be WikiLeaks. So WikiLeaks matters.
The other question the WikiLeaks drama over the last few months raises is, will there be a place for people like Daniel Ellsberg and Bradley Manning to release their material? On December the 2nd, the Wall Street Journal reported that Senator Joe Lieberman's staff called Amazon and asked why they were hosting WikiLeaks. Amazon later, the same day or the next day, took down WikiLeaks from Amazon. They said it wasn't directly connected to anything to do with Joe Lieberman. Later that day or the next day, I'm not entirely clear on the chronology, but within a day, a company called Tableau Software releases a statement, why we removed WikiLeaks visualizations. And then the end of the statement says, our decision to remove the data from our servers came in response to a public request by Senator Joe Lieberman, who chairs the Senate Homeland Security Committee, when he called for organizations hosting WikiLeaks to terminate their relationship with the website. So I'd like to ask Clay Shirky, and Clay, just to remind you, as an independent internet professional, adjunct professor, interactive communications at NYU, what's the significance of a senator calling up a privately owned company and kicking off WikiLeaks?
I think at least one interesting illustration from Lieberman and Evgeny Morozov, who I disagree with about quite a lot, but who I think has nailed this one absolutely. Morozov said, up until WikiLeaks, it was possible to imagine that self-restraint on the part of the U.S. government would be enough, that the government would work through legal channels rather than bullying corporate firms. And I think Lieberman has given the lie to that hope for self-restraint. The other interesting thing about Lieberman that I think has been enormously clarifying is that he is one of the few intellectually honest actors in this part of the debate. So, no, seriously, the Lieberman moment was this whole business of Ellsberg good, Manning bad, Pentagon Papers good, WikiLeaks bad, was basically a kind of attempt to wriggle out of the plain ramifications of the Pentagon Papers. And Lieberman said, no, that's not what we mean at all. What we mean is the Pentagon Papers case was wrongly decided. We would like to re-adjudicate it, and we want all media outlets to be punished. And he went on Fox News and said, after WikiLeaks, it would be good if we were to go after the New York Times. So Lieberman gave the lie to the idea that there was any kind of obvious legal or moral difference between the Times as a media outlet and WikiLeaks as a media outlet, and said essentially, we are after a National Secrets Act. And I think the fact that Lieberman's actions demonstrated that Amazon and eBay, Visa, MasterCard, Tableau, etc., could attempt to damage WikiLeaks' ability to distribute content with much less process than it takes to get on a terrorism watch list indicates how vulnerable the current infrastructure for public speech is to that kind of action.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or to get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to WikiLeaks, Free Speech and the Future of the Internet. Up next, we hear from Peter Thiel, president of Clarium Capital, Jonathan Zittrain, law and computer science professor at Harvard, and Roy Singham, founder and chairman of ThoughtWorks.
Peter, you were one of the founders of eBay. I'm sorry, PayPal. You later sold PayPal, but if PayPal later, after Amazon took down WikiLeaks, PayPal refused to do their transactions anymore, what do you make of this issue of the right of a private company to defend its commercial interest, the right of public discourse, the right, the need of the public to have access to whistleblowers? And to shorten the question, if you'd been running PayPal now, what would you have done?
Well, there's always this sort of thing where you don't have to answer difficult moral cases if you're not in a situation. So, you know, there are all sorts of people who get placed in very difficult situations where you either do what's right, and which is very courageous often, or you do what may be wrong and it's not very courageous, and most of the time people end up doing the latter. And fortunately, most of us do not find ourselves in either of those two situations. And I have not been running PayPal since 2002, and so I did not find myself confronted with that personal moral dilemma. Now, what I do think ends up happening in most of these cases is companies will cave. And they will, of course, say that that they are respecting people's rights and the privacy issues, but in practice they cave. And it's sort of companies are to the government like the government is with terrorists. You know, government with terrorists, the line is always, we never compromise with terrorists. And then there's the unspoken footnote is, except in every specific instance. and companies with the government, it's always, we're going to basically stand up for people's rights. And if you look at the various commentary around the WikiLeaks thing, you've got sort of various forms of corporate boilerplate to that effect. When you peel it back, maybe it doesn't mean quite as much. But then in every specific case, there is incredible pressure brought to bear on companies to cave. And I think, you know, I think there are sort of two somewhat different perspectives I'd offer. And that one is, there's obviously this, you know, somewhat of a moral perspective where we would like to have absolutely heroic people as CEOs running these companies and saying that we're not going to compromise, and occasionally you get that. And then I think we also should be trying to bring about is a balance of power that's a little bit different, where there aren't so many hooks that you have to be gone after, and where the penalties are not so extraordinarily high. And you know, we live in a society where there are a lot of laws. It's not clear how they get applied. There's a, you know, a book I read the other day, the average person in the US commits 3 felonies every single day. And it only takes, you know, a really clever prosecutor to find out. And so, you know, a given company, it's not just an issue with respect to a specific giving the government a right to this thing or that thing. It's likely there are all sorts of areas a company, or an individual for that matter, is engaged in that involves a lot of legally gray zones, because we have a lot of super complicated laws in our country and nobody really knows what the law is and what it isn't. It's incredibly vague and it can be used in all sorts of arbitrary ways. And that's why I believe that even though we would like to have very heroic people, the reality is most people, much less most CEOs, are not like Ellsberg. And that's why I think we have to put this in the context of really reducing the power of the state to use violence against individuals and corporations.
Jonathan Zittrain, am I saying it right?
Yep.
Is a professor of law and professor of computer science at Harvard. He's co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. What do we do? There's like a catch-22 here. You have a First Amendment defense if the government tries to close you down, but there's no First Amendment rights to the internet platform, which is fundamentally private, because you can't have a First Amendment case against a private company. You're a lawyer. Give us your sense of this.
Let me answer that by taking stock of where we're at so far in the conversation, because Peter said something that I thought was really interesting as he declined ever so politely and diplomatically not to answer your question about what he would do if he were running PayPal. And it almost gets back to Clay's point about Lieberman's intellectual honesty. He, in a way, gave you an intellectually honest answer, because the easy answer, especially given how the conversation has shaped up so far, would be like, if I were running PayPal today, I'd tell those feds to, you know, soak their heads. But he didn't say that. What I heard between the lines of what he said was, if somebody's running a company, they are under extreme pressure. And it can be awfully hard to second guess them, at least in the say that I would do something different, when they are confronted with, you name it, a Patriot Act Section 215 order that says, not only do you have to do this, but you can't tell anyone that we asked you to do it, and you know, here's our badge. And if you're designing a system from the top, and that used to be what we thought constitutionalists did when they forged a constitution for a state, you want to try to design the system recognizing that people have to play their roles and that there are few outliers among them that will break out of the role and say, I don't care what you say, I'm going to do something else instead. And somehow try to set up the pieces so that the roles are arrayed so that they are actually in healthy conflict and that sometimes one side wins, sometimes the other side wins, and the good stuff comes out of this conflict if the pieces are set up right. That's the classic idea of separation of powers. It's also an understanding of the role of the media, which is why I think a lot of people, including in Congress right now, have a hard time thinking of WikiLeaks as media. And if you could flick the switch in their head, this might not be true of Lieberman since he wants to send the New York Times to jail too, but many others would say, I see, if they were media, then I would treat them differently. So a lot has to do with roles. And so far what I've heard from Daniel Ellsberg, this is somebody whose role has been in perceiving a great injustice being done and very little recourse through official channels to leak. And then later to have history's judgment that it turned out that was the right thing to do. And that's how I hear him saying that, you know, somebody like that who not only leaked because he saw the injustice, but then had the President of the United States like engaging in wiretaps and kind of talk about micromanagement of what's going on in the country. Like, of course your view is gonna be, not only I don't trust government, but like, you know, the American government has really kind of let me down, might be part, to put it mildly, of his view. So all right, now let me circle around to your question by then taking on a role which is just to sort of prevent too much violent agreement among the panel here, so to play the role a little bit of the law professor. What I didn't hear from Daniel was an assertion that the government is not entitled to keep any secrets. And my guess is he wouldn't say that. What he said was he was against a hypothetical, not yet passed official state secrets act that would immediately and without question criminalize anything leaked that had been marked as classified. But there are some classified things, whether they're nuclear codes or you know something else, that we'd all get together and agree that should stay secret. If that's the case, I think the right question for all of us to ask is how do we want to set up the pieces on the board, knowing that there's been this huge sea change called the internet, for which it's much easier, and just generally technology, to take a thumb drive or a CD marked Lady Gaga, as was the case, and instead of it being Lady Gaga, it's all the secrets, you know, thousands and thousands of cables, and just put it out there. What do we do about that? And one possibility is to say, as the government trying to be enlightened about it, we can still be against leaks. We can be ready to prosecute certain leakers, maybe even prosecute certain intermediaries. The difference, by the way, might be motive. If your motive is to inform the public, that might be okay. If your motive is to damage the government of the United States and bring it down because you hate it and you are its enemy, that might be a different motive. And in criminal law, motive can matter a lot. That's also, by the way, when you think about the difference between a leaker and a spy, because there's only been a few leakers that have been brought under this title, a leaker is a spy who shares the stuff with everyone. Spies are more selective with whom they share the leaks, right? You're only leaking it to Russia. If you leak it to Russia and everyone else at the same time, you're a leaker, not a spy. But of course, everybody's getting it. But the difference is motive. The spy has a motive only to help Russia. The leaker may have other motives. So I think we have a healthier ecosystem if it's not true that primary parts of it are so controlled by a certain handful of corporate choke points that they are then compelled to play their role. And we should expect at some point, even though part of our role be to inveigh against them when they do play their role, to try to convince them maybe to be a little more free, we shouldn't have to have a system that depends on that level of response from companies. I would hope that the media sees its role as not simply corporate to, you know, maximize its profits, and good stories do that. So thinking through ways in which we could set up a system so that people could, in the words of one of my student groups that just presented on this, leak responsibly, which sounds like sort of a contradiction in terms, especially the likes of Joe Lieberman. But could you leak responsibly? Could you come up with a system that processes it so that we agree that maybe this should come to light, but there should be redactions to protect sources and methods? How can we build a system that will do that? And WikiLeaks itself maybe has slowly been pushed or co-opted into that direction. When they were first founded, the idea was send us the stuff, we'll send it out again.
Roy, do you want to do your 5 minutes and then we'll take questions?
Yeah.
Most of the people in this room probably remember, under the helpful eye of Peter Klein, an AT&T person, that on 611 Folsom Street in San Francisco, going back to these, you know, the warrantless wiretaps, secret rooms being built in there to allow NSA to tool billions of bits of information. These were not telephone conversations. These were internet communications, not only of AT&T, but 15 other providers. My question for the people in this audience, what is the mathematical chance that these rooms do not exist at Facebook and Google? It is inconceivable to me that such rooms or such kind of activities don't exist. I think, you know, we've tried to talk about, one of the things we've discussed is what are the values and principles that as the internet community we ought to try and protect. So we've sort of come up with three quick ones, or four. One, the existence of a free and transparent internet has actually been one of the most democratic things that has come across in human history. The fact that the barrier to entry that somebody with a cell phone in Alabama or Zimbabwe has access to the internet, this is one of the most profound leveling events in human history. And if we don't protect that thing that we have built so hard to cherish, we have failed our children. The freedom of the press should not be restricted to the New York Times, but has to include WikiLeaks. We don't fight that. We are giving up on 200 years of the rights that we have fought to protect for the freedom of the press. I believe that if you read the subpoena that was sent to Twitter, you could interpret that as asking for all the IP addresses of all the WikiLeaks viewers. Do you really think that the US government should know the IP addresses of 600,000 people who follow WikiLeaks? I find that a terrifying infringement on the right to association. The fourth principle that I think emerges is that the criticism of the government is the core of the First Amendment. And if anybody's under doubt, why is the US government going so vitriolically after WikiLeaks? They are obviously embarrassed about the war crimes and war difficulties that happened in Afghanistan and Iraq. Let's not pretend there's just not that issue gets swept under the rug. There's something that was wrong, and that has been brought to light, and thank goodness for WikiLeaks. I believe we are at an inflection point for the freedom of expression. We either fight now, and I wanted to close with President Madison. This is, I think, a great quote. You probably heard this. Since the general civilization of mankind, I believe there are more instances of the abridgment of freedoms of the people by gradual and silent encroachment of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations. James Madison. That, in my mind, is where we stand at the moment.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to excerpts from a panel discussion called WikiLeaks, Why It Matters, Why It Doesn't, featuring Daniel Ellsberg, Clay Shirky, Peter Thiel, Jonathan Zittrain, and Roy Singham. A link to the entire full-length discussion is available on our website, radioproject.org. Special thanks to the Real News Network for the audio. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website at radioproject.org to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. I'm Kyung Jin Lee. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.